Garth has cried, and Jim has cried, and I've already broken down a couple of times in the pew, so I'll try to keep it together for the next few minutes. But what I have today to share with you is something more personal than what I do on an average Sunday under the heading of how I spent my summer. Don't worry, this is not an extended slideshow of our family's time at the lake shore. We spent a time at many of Michigan's beautiful beaches, many of them for the first time, and they are as advertised and made us glad that we do live here, and we had a great time as a family. And I just want to start by saying again, as I said last week, thank you for the blessing and the gift of this sabbatical. It was a gift to our family. It was a gift to me. I'd never done one before. It felt extravagant. And that's why we're so grateful. But as you know, there's sometimes low-grade residual guilt, to borrow Mike Whitmer's phrase, that attends when you receive something as an extravagant gift. And the last day of our sabbatical, two Sundays ago, we were at a church, and it happened that the theme of the morning for the message was Sabbath. And one of the interesting things that was pointed out in that sermon is that we think of Sabbath and we think of that one day a week that is set aside for rest, for refreshment, and for worship. But the speaker pointed out appropriately that it's not just a weekly rhythm. There is an annual rhythm of two festivals that are a week of Sabbaths each that the people of Israel were to observe. So that's your biblical justification for summer vacation, in case you needed one. So I was pleased to hear that, but I said, but now I've got this, I've just been on this 6 weeks, like, where is that? And the speaker then pointed out that every 7 years, the people of Israel were to take 52 weeks of Sabbath. And every 50 years, they were to take back-to-back years of Sabbath. That this is something that God has built into in a layer of rhythms. And so that helped remove any vestiges of guilt that I was feeling. But it also made me realize that this is not just something for pastors. This is something, and I felt Moses' words to Joshua when Joshua saw other people prophesying and felt jealous for Moses' sake and said, Moses, should I stop them? And Moses said, would that all God's people were prophets. And so my hope, my dream now, and I know that it butts up against the realities of a fallen world, but would that all God's people could receive what we have received these last few weeks. And so I want to share with you some of what God has done that I think has a bearing for us. But this was the first time I'd had any such opportunity to do this. And so I sat there Monday morning, July 1st, with nothing to do. And that's not a normal sort of state of being for me, for a day maybe, but I was staring down the barrel of 42 days of nothing to do. And so I was journaling. I'm not a journaler. I wrote 3 journal entries in 42 days. It was not how I spent my summer. But I went back and looked at this first one this week as I kind of reflected, and it was interesting. A pastor friend of mine had prayed for me before the sabbatical that I would get to the end with no regrets. His prayer was answered, and it was affirmed as I looked back at what I had written. And so I had written in my journal 4 fears and 4 hopes that I had for this time, this 6 weeks. The first fear was that I would feel lost without my routines. I am a creature of habit. When I go to a restaurant that I've been to more than once, I order the same thing every time. I am a creature of habit, and I felt like if I don't have my regular routines, coming into the office every day, coming to this place of worship every Sunday with my usual role, what will I do? I felt very disoriented that Monday morning, and so it was a fear that I would just kind of be paralyzed by that. The second fear was that I would fill that void with new routines that would prevent refreshment. In other words, I would just replace my ordinary routine with something different, but that it would not be productive and restful and refreshing the way that it should. As a result, the third fear was that this time both felt long and too short, and that I'd still find a time to waste it. I would figure out a way to squander this opportunity, even though it felt on the one hand like there wasn't enough time, as long as 6 weeks feels. You know how 6 weeks can be. It can be very, very short and very long all at the same time. But fourthly, and I think at the root of all of those fears, was a fear that I wouldn't hear from God. That I would get to the end of this time and I'd have spent a lot of time with my family and a lot of time with myself, and that somehow I would not connect with God in a deep and meaningful way. That was a fear. So on the flip side of that, my first hope was that I would hear from God. And God answered that prayer in many ways over the course of the 6 weeks. My second hope was that I would accomplish a great deal, but without to-do lists. I live and die by to-do lists. My week begins with a yellow pad of paper, and I write things down, and I cross them off as I get them done. And sometimes if it turns out that I can't get the thing done, I just crumple up the piece of paper and start over. And sometimes when I do something that wasn't on the list, I add it to the list after I do it and then cross it off, just so I can have the thrill of crossing it off. This is my life. I didn't create a single to-do list for 42 days, but I accomplished a great deal. That was a new experience for me, but it was part of Sabbathing to Sabbath from to-do lists. One of my hopes was that my gifting would be sharpened by reading and writing. I intended to do a lot of reading and writing, and I did. I read and I wrote, and God used that to sharpen me in ways that I think you will see the benefits of in the coming weeks and months. And finally, my last hope was that my family would be glad that I did this. It's a big thing when Dad's usually gone for significant chunks of the week, and all of a sudden he's there for 6 weeks straight. But I think, Calvin, are you glad we did this? Are you grateful to the church? Yeah, I think we had a great time as a family, and they still love me as their dad. So the core question that I asked myself, that I asked God, and that as I wrestled that first day of the sabbatical, it was clear to me that something that I needed to sort out was, who am I? And this is where, as personal as what I'm going to share is for me today, I wouldn't be sharing if I didn't think it had some value for all of you, because all of us wrestle with this question of who we are. It's one of the reasons we want to explore this issue of vocation, because so often when you meet someone for the first time in our culture and society, you ask for their first name, and then it's either the second or third question that gets asked in the conversation. You know what it is. What is it? What do you do? What do you do? And what we really mean by that is, what do you get paid to do? And if you're someone that doesn't get paid to do anything, that doesn't mean you don't work, and we know that, but it can lead to like an embarrassing answer to that question, which is why I love that this study approaches the question of work not on the basis of what do you get paid to do, but what do you do? Everybody works. But we root our identity in our doing. And I wrestled with this question that my human being is more deeply rooted than my pastoral doing. Who I am is far more than a pastor. I am a pastor because of who I am, but that doesn't mean that that is what I am ultimately. My doing needs to come out of my being. Who I am is far more than what I do. So some of the reading that I did was revisiting things that had fed my soul earlier in my life. I read some new books that were extremely helpful, and I didn't put this reading list together strategically. I had a stack of books. Any of you that know me know I've always got a stack of books I'm, you know, supposed to be reading. And many of them come recommended to me by people, and so I just kind of went through that stack and I grabbed several. I didn't put it together as like a clear strategy, but it was amazing to me how all of them emphasized similar themes and sort of worked together over the course of the weeks and connected to what I was writing and the things that I was thinking through. And one of the books that I read two books about the book of Jonah, one I'd read before by Eugene Peterson called Under the Unpredictable Plant. And I'd read it several years ago and I remembered it was really compelling and powerful, didn't remember much specific about it, so I wanted to reread it and I'm really glad that I did. Jonah has been a formative book for me. Those of you that were here when we candidated, that was the first sermon I ever preached in this congregation, was on the book of Jonah. It's the first sermon I preached after I graduated seminary in California. Not because it's the sermon in my back pocket, but because it has become a cornerstone of how I think about Scripture, how I think about God, how I think about the gospel. And Eugene Peterson talks about Jonah as a parable for pastoral ministry. And if you've never thought of Jonah as a pastor before, you're in good company. I hadn't either. But Eugene Peterson makes a compelling case that Jonah has a lot to say to pastors. And at the heart of it is this question that Jonah wrestles with of identity. And so you recall that Jonah did something really astounding. He flees from the presence of the Lord to go to Tarshish because he doesn't like the assignment he's been given by God to go to Nineveh. We all know the story. And he shows up on this boat. And it seems like it's this cruise liner that he's hired out privately for himself. He's not just one of several passengers, he is the passenger. And so he's on his way to Tarshish, and this storm comes up, and he's dead asleep at the bottom of the ship, and the sailors are fighting for their lives, and they get him up, and they say, cry to your God. And that doesn't work. And so they cast lots to see from the gods who is the responsible party for this storm, and Jonah's the guilty party. And so they all look at him and they ask him, tell us on whose account this evil has come upon us. What is your occupation? What do you do? And where do you come from? What is your country? And of what people are you? They're asking him identity questions. Who are you that this storm has come upon us? Something must be really wrong with you to get the gods so upset as to hurl this storm at our ship. And look at his answer. He said to them, I am a Hebrew, and I fear Yahweh, the God of heaven, who made the sea and the dry land. I've preached on Jonah a bunch of times, and I'd never noticed until looking at it this time that Jonah's problem is stated clearly in this verse. His primary identity is not the God he serves. His primary identity is his nationality. That's why he won't go to Nineveh. Nineveh is the sworn enemy of his people. His primary identity is that he's a Hebrew. And so for me, if my primary identity is that I'm a pastor and I serve the Lord Jesus Christ and his gospel. Whoa, no. Back up that truck, pastor. I serve the Lord Jesus Christ and his gospel, and I'm a pastor. Do you see the difference? It matters. First thing that comes out of your mouth is the truth. Only after that do we start to cover it up. Oh, and by the way, yeah, that God is kind of important in that equation. And so we know what happens next. The sailors, more righteous than the prophet they're carrying, try to save his life, row into shore, because he says, throw me overboard. They try to save his life. That doesn't work. And finally, they pray to his God and say, don't hold us guilty for this man's blood. We're doing the best we can. And they throw him overboard. And Jonah winds up in this big fish. And Jonah was in the belly of the fish 3 days and three nights. And Jonah prayed to Yahweh his God from the belly of the fish. Twice the verse says that he's in the belly of the fish. He's in this place of confinement. He was going for an open ocean cruise of some duration, and God puts him in the smallest, darkest, most cramped condition imaginable for 3 days and nights. Why? Because when we are not confined, it is easy to forget who we are. When there are not limits placed around us, it is easy to imagine that we are the authors of our own destiny, of our own fate, to imagine that we are in charge to make God in our image, to make a God that matches who we are, who we think we are. So Jonah has to be confined. And in that confinement, Jonah prays an interesting prayer. It's in Jonah 2, and we're not going to read the whole prayer. I just want to highlight some things that get repeated in chapter 2 of that prayer. In verse 4, Jonah identifies his confinement as being driven away from God's sight. And yet he says, I will look again to your holy temple. He asks in verse 7 that his prayer would come to God into God's holy temple. And then in verse 9, he says, with the voice of thanksgiving, I will sacrifice to you. What I have vowed, I will pay. Four or five times in this prayer, Jonah speaks of the temple or of God's presence. And this is where it's really interesting what Jonah's choice was at the beginning. And again, something I hadn't really thought about before. It does not say that Jonah fled from Nineveh. It doesn't say that he fled from a place. The text very clearly says, in a couple of places, he fled from the presence of Yahweh. Doesn't just say he fled from God. They fled from the presence of Yahweh. And what does God do? God confines him in a space where all he can connect with is the presence of Yahweh. And his heart is redirected towards God's presence, manifested at that time and place in Jerusalem at the temple. And that's why he speaks in that language. And the conclusion of his prayer is salvation belongs to Yahweh. In other words, it doesn't belong to me. It doesn't belong to me because I'm a Hebrew. It belongs to Yahweh. It is entirely God's good gift, not mine by merit, not mine by who I am or what I do, but simply because God is a saving God. Now, we know the story doesn't end there, and that Jonah has only imperfectly learned that lesson, but the confinement drives him into God's presence. And so the sabbatical for me was a sort of confinement. It removed all of the things that I had identified myself with, my activity in ministry. So it was just me. It was just me and the wide open space, which felt confining. And we drove through the plains a few years ago on our way to Colorado, and open space can feel really confining. The wide open prairies, as beautiful as they are, feel extremely, to me at least, disorienting and like get me out of here. I felt trapped by the wide open spaces. Sabbatical was similar for me. I felt confined. And I realized very quickly that it was vital for me to disconnect from church. And I've put church in quotes on this screen. And I don't mean to make Kurt a liar. Kurt assured you that we would be fellowshipping at other churches over the course of the 6 weeks. We went to church services twice in 6 weeks. So there is my confession. It is good for the soul. But the reason is this. The first week that I went to church, it was not what church is supposed to be. And it wasn't the fault of the congregation that we found ourselves among. It was a good sermon about Jonah 2, of all things, and I didn't know that before I showed up at church that week. The music was well executed and God-honoring. The people were friendly and gracious, welcoming to us. I did try to get away without telling people I was a pastor, and one guy was really after our information because we were guests and he wanted to, you know, really wanted to make sure we were connecting, and I finally just like, I'm a pastor, I'm on sabbatical, I'm really just here, you know, as a fraud this morning, I'm sorry. But we got out of, we missed a Starbucks gift card in that, which Kelsey rebuked me for later. She's like, take the Starbucks gift card. I felt wrong. But it wasn't worshipful and it wasn't restful because I was in work mode. Right away, I'm critiquing everything that's going on. I'm evaluating everything. It wasn't focused on God. It was professional and clinical. I didn't like it. I didn't like it for all the wrong reasons. And I realized I've made, in some ways, my connection with God dependent on these forms and functions, and I need to figure out what it means to connect with God apart from that. So I wasn't being lazy. In that, it was important for me to acknowledge my limits. It is easy, particularly as a pastor, to feel like I'm expected to and can do things that I can't do. It is easy to feel like the expectation is that I'm going to fix everything, make it all better, straighten people out. I'm being honest. I can do none of those things. I really can't fix anything. I can't make anything better. And I certainly can't straighten people out. And I'm exhibit A in my inability to straighten people out. I can't fix myself. But it's easy to feel that. And so acknowledging my limits. Part of what Sabbath means for all of us is stopping working so that we can see just how ineffective our work is in the first place. How little of what we produce is dependent on our effort, and how much of what we produce is dependent on God. It's a necessary reminder for creatures. I was sharing with a group of pastors about the sabbatical, and I said, sabbatical at the end of the day is a reminder that God is God and I'm not. That's the bottom line. If you take nothing else away from that this morning, I was reminded, embarrassing that any of us should need the reminder, but we all do, that there is a God and we are not God. And so in that, I identified some pitfalls for me, some common pitfalls, and these are not unique to me. They're common to pastors, but I think common to all of us, and one of them is self-sufficiency. In other words, I have been gifted. I'm aware of that. I have abilities. I have skills. Acknowledging my limits doesn't mean that there's none of that. I have experiences that are useful, but when I start using those as the power for what I do, I have disconnected myself from God. When my ministry rests in those things, when my sense of competency comes from those things and not from my connection with God, I'm in dangerous waters. And it's not that those things aren't good. It's not that they're not important. It's not that you shouldn't look at those things in a pastor. It's just that subtle reversal of, I am a Hebrew and. I serve the God of the universe. What's prior? What's primary? What's the most important thing? A second pitfall is the motivations. And let me just say this. When we came back last week, one of the things that I recognized as being a missing ingredient when we went to other churches is that they're not our people. I don't know those people. They're my brothers and sisters in Christ for sure. Looking forward to a never-ending party with all of them. But they're not my people. These are my people. I wouldn't say these things to those congregations if I were asked to speak, but I can say them to you because you're my people. And so I can be honest that sometimes I can identify mixed motivations. I get paid for what I do, which is a tremendous privilege, but sometimes I do what I do because I'm being paid, and that's not the reason that I should be doing it. It's not the primary one that I find problematic. The other is approval, that I do what I do to be thought well of, because I know it's appreciated. It's a subtle snare. I can do it because it's expected, because it's an obligation. I think we can all feel that. If you do have a paying gig that happens on Monday, you might show up tomorrow either because you're getting paid or to keep your boss's approval, or if you're the boss, to get your employee's approval, or simply because you know you have to. For me, the status, the fact that I can look at this and say, I am a pastor, in some way I have arrived, that's a dangerous thing to think. Rather than recognizing I'm in process, I'm on a journey, and to be open to that. And it can become that source of identity. That if I wasn't a pastor, I'm not sure I'd know who I was. And so I keep at being a pastor because I don't know what I would be otherwise. Those are not my primary motivations all the time. I just identify that these are things that are kind of in the background that I need to be aware of. But the biggest one that I identified is that I can miss God's presence while presuming to minister it. As we were singing that last song, I See the Lord, it echoed what I took away from this sabbatical. That's our job. At the end of the day, that's all we're to do, is to see God for who God is and to reflect that to others. And it is possible and all too common to be part of a church, whether a pastor or a member, and miss God's presence while presuming to minister God's presence to others. To get caught up in the trappings and the traditions and the formulas and all of that, and somehow miss seeing God in the midst of it. And this is Jonah's core problem. This is what's really wrong with Jonah. Because the prayer in the belly of the fish doesn't fix him. He was angry on the boat, it's why he fled, and he's still angry in chapter 4, that chapter we don't talk about in Sunday school with the kids. Everyone thinks it ends in chapter 3 with the Ninevites repenting. But Jonah's not repented, and here's what he says. He prays to Yahweh after seeing the Ninevites spared and says, O Yahweh, is this not what I said when I was yet in my own country? There's that identity. That is why I made haste to flee to Tarshish. He's laying it out for God. This is why I fled from your presence. It's because I knew that you are a gracious God and merciful, slow to anger and abounding in steadfast love and relenting from disaster. Jonah says, I fled from you because I know exactly who you are and exactly what you're like. And I don't like it. It's not me. And so when your identity is taken away from you, your life is over. And so he says, please take my life from me, for it is better for me to die than to live. If we do not see God rightly, we will not be transformed ourselves, and we will seek our ends. So now what? One of the things I really didn't want to do on this sabbatical is go away and come back with a yellow pad with to-do lists for our church. I didn't want to go away and think about all the things we need to do as a church. Sometimes that's what pastors do with sabbaticals. So they go away and they try to figure everything out. That would have been my tendency. I said right away, I don't want that to be the outcome. So I didn't come back with like a prescription for us. I know just as much about what we ought to be doing next as I did 8 weeks ago. I didn't give it a second thought. But there are some themes that I think I want to characterize who I am and how I approach this thing and that I think will be beneficial to us. One of the things that I learned, that prayer in Jonah 2 is not an original creation. He copied it all right out of the Psalms. And that's a good thing. The Psalms are given to us to teach us how to pray because they show us who God is. And so I have started the discipline suggested by Eugene Peterson on the basis of centuries of church tradition of praying the Psalms once a month. And it is striking to me how much the Psalms talk about coming into the presence of God. That at the end of the day, that's what the psalmist wants, is to be in God's presence. And so the Psalms teach us to be transformed by beholding God's beauty. And I love what Royce Evans shared with you all about the struggle. Welcome to the struggle. The struggle is to keep our eyes fixed on Jesus. That song we sang comes right out of Isaiah 6. Isaiah beholds God in God's glory and comes away transformed, sent out to mirror God's presence to his people. We are transformed not by our effort, not by work, not by any of that. We are transformed when we see God rightly. And because so much around us doesn't look like God, it is a struggle to keep our gaze fixed there. But when we do behold God's beauty, God's goodness, and I love what was shared, and I'm sorry, I don't remember if it was Carl. I listened to all the messages while we were on sabbatical that were preached here. If it was Carl or if it was Tim Gombas who said, talked about Exodus when Moses asks to see God's glory and for God to declare God's name. Hopefully what Jonah said in Jonah 4 sounded familiar, because that's what God says when he's asked his name. Yahweh, Yahweh, a gracious and merciful God, slow to anger and relenting concerning calamity, not visiting iniquity, but pouring grace to thousands of generations. That's who God is. And when we see that, how can we help but fall in love with that God? So often we think about things that we know about God, things that we believe about God, truths that we know about God, but we don't talk often about the beauty of God that should stir and thrill our hearts. But that's the language of the Psalms. Psalms speak of loving God and God's salvation and being drawn by what is winsome and beautiful to who God is. And so I will say this, thank you for the music. I'm not someone that usually, I can take it or leave it, let me just put it that way. I love music when it's there, but I don't seek it out. At least I didn't. And then I went to some other churches, and the music was executed well, and they were good songs, and everybody was technically doing. We came back last week, and I was moved, and I thought, well, maybe that was just, you know, like a one-off, like, you know, they were having a good week, or I was just in like a raw place because I missed you all so much. And then I came in this morning, and it was even more like, we got a good thing going on here at Berean, those of you involved in the music ministry, and it ministers God's. I don't know about you, but I feel like I saw God today. I was like, I don't think I have to get up and do anything because we've seen God. Let's go home, like, you know, call it a day. Mission accomplished. Because that's our mission, is to see God. What that does for me, my tendency is to live in either a state of fear or frenzy. So life comes at you, right? Because you hear these things about, like, you know, the contemplative life, and you're like, that sounds great, but then there's real life, right? Like, life is not lived at the top of a hill on a monastery. Life is not lived on sabbatical. And my tendency is to respond to that with either fear that paralyzes me, like, I don't know what to do, or to try to do everything, just frenetically, you know. When we see God accurately and rightly, and we carry that vision with us, it keeps us from fear and being paralyzed, keeps us from thinking that we're going to run harder and faster and fix it all. And so here's the rhythm. We talked about this a few months ago, and this is something we're going to talk about a lot in the coming weeks. Breathing in and breathing out. I read a great little book recently that identifies this, that in the world, everything is a back and forth. Your heart can't just constantly pump out blood, it's got to also pump in. You can't just breathe out, you've got to breathe in. We give and we receive. We speak to one another, we speak to God, God speaks back, we listen. Others speak out. We listen. Every time you speak out, somebody's listening. Every time you give, somebody's receiving. We're to give and we're to receive. And so I have identified and reminded myself more clearly of what my vocation is. It's easy to get distracted by a lot of other things, but here's my vocation. Here's what I aim to do a lot more of in the coming weeks and months. It's what the apostles said of their vocation in Acts chapter 6. We will devote ourselves to prayer and to the ministry of the word, breathing in, breathing out, speaking to God and allowing God to speak back, speaking to others and hearing God's word from others, breathing in, breathing out. We die if we don't do those things. We have to do both of those things. And I just want to say this, and I know I'm 5 minutes over, and I thought I was going to give you your 15 minutes back from last week, and I apologize. Every time I've said this verse out loud, until this week when I decided to include it in this message, I've always said the ministry of the word and prayer. I've always put the primacy on what I'm going to say. But notice what, prayer, and then the ministry of the word. If what I say isn't rooted in my fellowship with God, I'm not sure I'm saying much of value. So that is my commitment to you on the backside of sabbatical, is that I am endeavoring to struggle to keep God's face and his presence before me so that what I say will be life-giving. Not because of anything true of me, because it's true of God. And I also, and you'll hear more about this next Sunday, I hope to hear from God through all of you quite a bit in the next year. Let me pray for us. And I think we're going to sing a song. We better sing a song. God, you are good. You are beautiful. You're merciful and gracious, slow to anger, abounding in steadfast love. And we stand as the recipients of those good things. I ask for myself that our hearts would be thrilled and drawn to your presence. That what would be true of us as a people would be nothing more than that we are people who dwell in your presence and love it. And so we ask that you would continue to make yourself known in our midst. And not just here on Sunday, but wherever we find ourselves at 9 a.m. tomorrow. And we ask it because of Jesus by the Spirit.